Good evening. I call to order the Shoreline City Council regular meeting for Monday, November 24th, 2025. Will you please join me in the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Mayor Roberts.
Here.
Deputy Mayor Mork.
Aye. Are you here? Thank you.
Councilmember Ramsdale. Councilmember Scully.
Present.
Councilmember Adamasu.
Present.
Councilmember Popey.
Here.
Councilmember Robertson.
Here.
Deputy Mayor Mark. Do you have a motion?
I have a motion to excuse Councilmember Ramsdale for personal reasons.
I second that.
There's a motion to excuse Councilmember Ramsdale for personal reasons. Any objections? Seeing no objections, that motion is adopted by unanimous consent. The next item is approval of tonight's agenda. If there are no objections or comments, that agenda is adopted by unanimous consent. Next on the agenda is the report of the city manager, Mr. Ellington. No.
We won't draft you for council.
Good evening, council. If you hadn't had a chance to visit the Shorelight's winter light display yet, I encourage you to check it out and invite your friends and family. The lights will be on view until January 11th, 2026. This year, we also are introducing Bites at the Lights. You can view the Shorelight's winter display and enjoy food from several local vendors during your visit. Food trucks will be available most days through January 11th. Visit bit.ly/bitesatthelights to view the full calendar of vendors. As a reminder, there are still a couple of days left to donate to the Shoreline Food Drive. You could drop off your donations at City Hall, the Shoreline Teen Center, or several other locations across the city throughout the month. We're asking residents to ensure that storm drains in their neighborhoods are clear of leaves and debris. Please rake leaves and debris out of the street in front of your home and throw them away in your yard waste bins. Keeping your home gutters and downspouts clear can help prevent flooding and water damage to your home and property. If you see a storm drain or ditch backing up or flooding a roadway, please call 206-801-2700 immediately. As always, our team is ready to respond to storms this winter season. Join us this Tuesday, November 25th, for a walk along the Richmond Beach waterfront. Meet up with our volunteer walker, Donna, at 10 a.m. at the Richmond Beach Community Park tennis courts. Come out, get active, and enjoy a walk with your friends and neighbors. City facilities will be closed Thursday and Friday for the holidays. All of us at City Hall would like to wish the residents of Shoreline a safe and happy Thanksgiving and Native American Heritage Day. We are thankful to serve such a supportive, engaged community. We hope everyone can celebrate and spend time with family and friends over the long weekend. And finally, just a couple of public reminders. The next City Council meeting will take place on Monday, December 1st at 7 p.m. here in the Council Chambers. The Planning Commission will meet on Thursday, December 4th, also in the Council Chambers at 7 p.m. And the Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Services Tree Board's next meeting is also on December 4th at 7 p.m. at City Hall. And for more information about these upcoming meetings, please visit shorelinewa.gov/calendar. And that concludes the City Manager's report. And I'll return to my seat.
Thank you. Not for going back to your seat, but thank you for the report. Are there any council reports this evening? Councilmember Scully.
Thank you. I attended the Behavioral Health Legislative Forum. All councils across the county were invited. It was really mostly focused on legislators, but we did get some updates on sort of what's going on down in Olympia. And unfortunately, the news isn't great just for funding reasons. And at the moment, Shoreline is sort of ahead of the curve on the services we provide, and I unfortunately don't think we can expect a lot of help from Olympia for the next couple of years, although there was definitely an acknowledgement that there are some big holes in the safety net at various points and plans to get them accomplished if and when a revenue source appears.
Thank you. Deputy Mayor Mark.
Attended National League of Cities Conference It was very informative on many different elements that are important to the city.
Thank you. Councilmember Adomasu.
I also attended the National League of Cities along with other council members. A lot of important information on emerging issues from leading experts. I feel like I was in college again, learning about all these different cutting-edge solutions for affordable housing, homelessness, et cetera. It was a very good conference. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Popey.
Yes, I was there with everybody. It was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Robertson.
It's great to attend these events, and yes, there's so much to learn, a lot of takeaways, and lots of ideas that I will be bringing to, you know, parks and staff and all the various city capacities. One, something we learned about was the Dignity Index, and I brought home some literature about that I am going to, you know, utilize here in my role as a council member, but also in my, you know, personal work life. And so anybody who's listening would like to look that up, the Dignity Index. Check it out.
Thank you. And before I talk about my time at NLC, I will say that I was had the opportunity to speak before the National Congress of American Indians. They had their conference in Seattle last week, and I was able to talk about I was on a panel with Senator Claudia Kaufman, Representatives Chris Stearns and Deborah Lechenoff, and was moderated by Seattle Councilmember Deborah Juarez. So a great group talking about some of the issues that indigenous officials face in Washington State in serving in office. And then at National League of Cities, I was honored to serve as part of the nominating committee. And we recommended a great group of candidates to serve on the board. And recommended, and the whole organization selected and elected Kevin Creamer, a council member from Louisville, Kentucky, to serve as president. Van Johnson, the mayor of Savannah, Georgia, to serve as first vice president, and Doreen Garland, the vice mayor of Tempe, Arizona, to serve as second vice president. We also, during the annual business meeting, we had a discussion about how we can amend one of the resolutions to protect residents from ICE activities. That amendment did not get the two-thirds majority to pass, so we are going to work on alternative ways to issue a statement saying that we need to protect human rights and the constitutional rights of our residents. Okay, public comment. Next on the agenda is public comment. This is the portion of the meeting where members of the public may address the City Council on agenda items or other matter pertaining to city business for 3 minutes or less. How many people have signed up tonight?
There are 3 people signed up this evening, and all in person.
Okay. If when your name is called, please come to the podium and state your name and city of residence.
Okay, you can go ahead and line up at the podium. We've got Ruth Williams, Kathleen Russell, and Botts Danson.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today. I am Ruth Williams with Thornton Creek Alliance, and I have a few comments on agenda item 8A. We shared our concerns with the Planning Commission at a previous meeting, but they were not discussed very much, and so I'd like to bring them here directly to you. Code number 20.30.336, critical areas, reasonable use permit. I mean, we all see the reason for this, but it's important to keep a tight rein on these permits. They can be used to create truck-sized loopholes and significantly diminish the success of efforts to restore and preserve riparian management zones. To help keep the brakes on when a reasonable use permit is requested, please require a variance application. And then the second one is code 20.80.320, fish and wildlife habitat, paragraph F, riparian management zone interruptions, which refers to when there is, you know, building or impervious surface in the RMZ that kind of has to stay there. But if you require the planting of trees and native plants, even in those zones where you have additional impervious surface, you can do a lot to kind of bridge that habitat gap and keep it going for wildlife and also for people. And that is it. Thank you for hearing our concerns.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good evening, Council. Kathleen Russell, resident of Shoreline, on behalf of Safe Shoreline Trees. We support Thornton Creek Alliance's request to strengthen 2080-320 fish and wildlife habitat buffer zones and RMZs, as Ruth explained. Item F, please include the requirement of planting trees and native plants. We are also concerned about the impact that bikes and scooters have on critical areas, trails, which can harm tree roots and cause erosion. These concerns were brought to the attention at the public hearing on November 6th, and we now ask Council to reconsider. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, council members. My name is Bob Danson. I'm the general manager of the Olympic View Water and Sewer District. I have submitted detailed comments, written comments for the record, which include citations and supporting resolutions from our board. I have also previously submitted comments to the city SEPA process, and I will summarize our key concerns for your consideration. The city's draft critical areas ordinance currently states that there are no critical aquifer recharge areas within Shoreline. That statement is not accurate. The Deer Creek Wellhead Protection Area lies partly within the city. The Wellhead Protection Area, or WIPA, is a scientifically mapped recharge area for a public drinking water supply. Under Washington's Growth Management Act, wellhead protection areas like this meet the definition of a CARA, and the city has a legal obligation to protect it. The state's minimum guidelines require cities to classify and protect aquifer recharge areas where supported by best available science. And in this case, the science requiring this action is actually exceptionally strong. Our WIPA was delineated using the most advanced modeling method recognized by the Department of Health, supported by extensive site-specific data. Since the aquifer that supplies Deer Creek Springs is extremely shallow, exposed in places, lacks protective till, and is vulnerable to contamination from surface and infiltration stormwater, it includes a buffer zone to protect it from contaminants like PFAS and urban runoff, which we know now PFAS is persistent and mobile and can take up to 18 years to reach the source from where we're talking about the area right now. Once they do, cleanup is extraordinarily difficult and often impossible. The only viable approach is prevention. So for many years, Olympic View has consistently notified the city about this recharge area and the need to protect it. Our board adopted Resolution 1130 and Resolution 1149, which are attached to my written comments. Both document the legal requirements and hydrogeologic risk and were sent to the city in the past along with the Watershed Protection Plan. For these reasons, we respectfully request adding one important line to the critical areas ordinance. The Deer Creek Wellhead Protection Area buffer, as identified by Olympic View Water and Sewer District, is a recognized recharge zone for a public water supply and shall be designated and treated as a critical aquifer recharge area consistent with the protection standards in Appendix C of the district's Watershed Protection Plan. This is a minimum protective measure supported by the best available science. Leaving the CAO unchanged leaves this drinking water resource unrecognized and unprotected. And this is a really important point right here, is that as city staff and decision makers change over time, including myself, the risk is that much more critical in this area and to actually recognize it, because if it's overlooked, it could make a considerable issue for the community. So thank you, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Those are all the people who have signed up tonight. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to address the council at this time? Okay, seeing none. The next item is approval of the consent calendar. Is there a motion?
I move approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
The consent calendar has been moved and seconded. Will the clerk please conduct a vote?
Councilmember Scully?
Aye.
Councilmember Poby?
Aye.
Councilmember Robertson?
Aye.
Deputy Mayor Mork?
Aye.
Mayor Roberts?
Aye.
Councilmember Adamasu?
Aye.
That motion passes 6-0. The next item on the agenda is a discussion of ordinance number 1045, amending Shoreline Municipal Code chapters 2020, 2030, 2050, and 2080, reflecting updates to the critical areas regulations. And we have a staff report. Welcome.
Thank you. All right, and we're displaying properly. Good evening, Council. My name is Elise Keim, Planning Manager here with the city, to bring forward the topic of the Critical Areas Code update. So what I have in store for you this evening is an overview of why we are updating the Critical Areas Code, an overview of what is changing, the impacts to Shoreline, and some discussion of the draft code itself. So why are we updating the Critical Areas Code? Well, cities are required to regulate critical areas by the Growth Management Act, and cities are required to periodically review and update their critical areas regulations. The state legislature gives cities an additional 12 months after a comprehensive plan update to do this update to the Critical Areas Code. So it happens about every 10 years. What is changing in Shoreline's Critical Area Code? This time, it is all about streams. In 2020, the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, or WDFW, published some updated scientific and management guidance for local jurisdictions about streams. Their guidance really increased a focus on riparian ecosystems. These are the lands, as seen in the image here, that are on either side of a stream. They have major influence on a stream's health. And per DFW's guidance, these areas are to be regulated as critical areas, not as buffers, which was the previous approach to protecting streams. So, how big is a riparian management zone? WDFW's guidance uses something called site potential tree height. This is the height of the dominant tree species at 200 years old. That's the age that a tree needs to be in order to be considered old growth. This was used because WDFW's modeling assumptions rely on the fact that old growth is needed for a full riparian ecosystem functions. DFW did modeling throughout the state of Washington, and in Shoreline provided an estimate for what the site potential tree height is in Shoreline, and that is 200 feet. So how big is a riparian management zone? In Shoreline, the site potential tree height is 200 feet. Therefore, the riparian management zone width is 200 feet on either side of a stream. So this is a pretty big increase in regulated critical areas in Shoreline. The previous stream regulations, which you see summarized on the slide here, focused on buffers. And the buffers actually varied in size depending on the presence or absence of fish. WDFW's guidance is to move away from that model and towards using site potential tree height instead. So, now the regulations focus on the riparian management zone, so not a buffer, and that it utilizes site potential tree height. So the previous regulations, it's a little hard to see on the slide here, but these are in fact buffers of different sizes in Shoreline, and it captured impacted around 1,400 properties under the code that was adopted in 2015 and is still in effect today. The proposed revised code using site potential tree height impacts approximately 1,900 properties in the city. And as you can see, the impacted properties are all over the city. They're in a variety of zones. Largely, they are residential, but there are some commercial, recreational, and institutional properties that are impacted as well.
And just a question for people who are looking at the presentation. The properties affected, the ones in orange, outlined in orange, correct?
Correct, yes. And as you see, maybe some of them are more heavily impacted by the riparian management zone, and others maybe it's just a little bit has been clipped by the riparian management zone, but how you do the GIS analysis, just right. counts them.
And just one more question while we're looking at the map. I mean, is this the proposed?
This would be the proposed area of effect, yes.
Thank you.
So when discussing these much larger critical areas within shoreline, Commission really focused on striking this balance of protecting the environment and providing flexibility to existing properties. WDFW was very clear in their guidance on what their goals were, their assumptions and caveats. As an agency, DFW is mandated to focus on the well-being of fish and wildlife. And so their goal is to have fully functioning riparian management zones throughout Washington State. Their assumption is that an old growth forest is necessary to have that fully functioning riparian management zone. And so therefore a desired future condition for riparian management zones is an old growth forest. DFW was very clear in their guidance that they only considered ecological impacts, not anything like social or economic impacts. They correctly pointed out that needs to go through local processes, which is what we are doing now. The Growth Management Act is another area where we look to guidance and clarity on what target we need to meet. The Growth Management Act has a concept called no net loss of ecological function. So while DFW's target is to have fully functioning, pristine riparian management zones, the Growth Management Act recognizes that existing development has occurred. Often these areas that are critical areas are not pristine. And so it's actually a requirement to have no net loss of ecological function. So it's whatever the existing baseline is when the regulations are adopted. Growth Management Act also really is concerned with our old growth forests. And in fact, its approach is to concentrate growth and development in existing urbanized areas so that we preserve our forest and farmland in the state. The Growth Management Act also requires that any development regulations be consistent with the comprehensive plan. Our comprehensive plan has some excellent language about making sure that we're balancing environmental protections while also in protecting property rights and encouraging housing choices in shoreline. And then finally, the Growth Management Act actually has a number of goals, 15 in total, that all need to be balanced. They aren't in any particular ranked order. It is for local communities to discuss and decide on that balance. Some examples are things like protecting private property rights, reducing sprawl, and protecting the environment. So ultimately, Commission's recommendation was to use WDFW's riparian management zone width, but maintain flexibility for property owners in recognition of shoreline's existing developed context. So what is in the draft code? Well, it actually does a lot, but for the purposes of our discussion this evening, I am focusing on the riparian management zone policy choices. Commission really grappled with some important policy decisions around that, and I wanted to highlight those for your attention. Of course, if you have questions about other things in the code, I'm happy to speak to those, but I was going to focus on riparian management zones here. So the first proposal is to allow for reduction to riparian management zone width if it meets certain criteria. So we have these 200-foot riparian management zones, but if it's an area that's already degraded or impacted by development, if a professional assessment is done, that area could be reduced by up to 25%. And then with the requirement that the remaining area be enhanced in some way, usually through plantings, things like that, removing invasive species, and that it's monitored so that ultimately we're seeing an ecological lift. The concept here being a smaller and more functional riparian management zone is a better outcome than a larger and less functional riparian management zone. And it gives property owners the ability to reduce the regulated critical areas on their property. The next concept proposed in the draft code is around physically separated riparian management zones. Again, the city has a lot of development that's already occurred, and just because a stream is in one location, there may be existing development like a paved road or buildings that are interrupting the ecological functions of that riparian management zone. So the concept is that with a professional assessment that says, hey, there's really not an ecological relationship going on here, therefore that area is not appropriate to regulate as a critical area. So that helps existing property owners on areas that are already developed and not necessarily be regulated as critical areas.
So can you, on that, can you walk through what the numbers mean?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So these are also in the staff report. There are four examples here on the screen, and they are just conceptual in nature. I think there could be others that are out there, but example number one, there is a paved road between the stream, which you see at the bottom, and some houses that are on the other side of the street. So because there is so much development between the stream and those homes, if someone wanted to do, let's say, a porch addition or something there on their house, it wouldn't necessarily be regulated as a critical area because there's just enough stuff in between. Concept number two is showing a building between the stream and the building that's proposing some sort of development. So again, there's that physical barrier. And then the third example is, say you've got a stream in your backyard, but you're just trying to do an addition on the front. The building itself, your house, is providing an interruption of riparian management ecosystem functions. And then four is an example of like a child swing set that's not going to be sufficient enough to be separating the ecological relationship. And then our third concept, again, for trying to balance between existing developed properties and environmental protections, is this concept of a one-time expansion of a building. The concept here is to allow expansions of development if they meet specific criteria, this being it's size limited, it's not getting closer to the stream, and it's at least 100 feet away. Importantly, this isn't a free pass to impact and degrade a critical area. A critical areas report is absolutely still required. There would still be requirements for mitigation. What we're trying to do here is not require properties to go through a very lengthy and expensive process called a critical areas reasonable use permit. This is where you would have to not only get your critical areas report and mitigation, but have additional public process, including a hearing in front of the hearing examiner in order to do any sort of development or expansion of your property. The concept here is we have made a policy choice about what is reasonable without going through additional process. If someone wanted to have a larger addition on their home or they want to get closer to the stream, then we would say, well, you still need a critical areas report and mitigation, but you're also going through a critical areas reasonable use process. So that's the concept here. So commission met several times earlier this year discussing the draft critical areas code. We have specific development code amendment criteria, which were reviewed and discussed by commission, and ultimately their recommendation is to approve the ordinance. And that's what I have for you for the presentation.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions? Councilmember Scully.
I do, and they're pretty weedy. Can you pull up 8A109 of the staff report, which is 2080-320F?
Can I? What was that? 880? 8A what?
What was the number again?
It's 8A109. If you're looking at the PDF, it is 109, page 109 of the PDF.
I'm gonna pull that up.
Thank you.
And then if you can zoom in on the bottom paragraph, which is F. I'm gonna wait till it's up so okay. I don't confuse everybody.
Thank you.
So my question is, so we've got physically separated and functionally isolated riparian management zones. I'm not clear what happens when you identify one, and here's why I have that question. If you look down about halfway through, you see a strike through, which means it's out of the ordinance. It says, once determined by the director, based upon a submitted critical area report to be a physically separated and functionally isolated stream buffer, development proposals shall be allowed in these areas. So that's gone, and this paragraph doesn't tell me anymore what happens when you identify one of those. So where in the code are the regulations for what happens once you've identified one?
So what we have here is the, and we can certainly add in that clarity of the language if necessary, but the concept is if determined that it's physically separated and functionally isolated, it is not regulated as a critical area, that okay. that it has been interrupted.
So it doesn't say that. And so I think it needs to say that. And again, this is a, you know, there's hundreds of pages here. I may have missed the cross-reference, but I don't think I did. And we need to say what happens once we've identified this. And that tracks on to the public comments we've received, which is I'm not sure we want to just say, okay, you're done, right? And the one that springs to my mind is actually, it's not a stream, it's a lake, but you've got the Burke-Gilman Trail, the Interurban Trail, I always do that. The Interurban Trail, a parking lot, and then you've got, I think it's Echo Lake on the other side, and most of the buffer is a parking lot. Like, it's 300 feet out, and almost all of it's paved. And we're not at a point where we're going to require that stuff to be torn out. And so, like, what are we doing saying it's a 300-foot buffer when it's all parking lot? But it seems to me that if we've got that, this functionally separated area, if there's a little bit on the other side, we don't want to just say, open, you know, do whatever you want with it. It's no longer regulated. We want to say something along the lines of what's been proposed, that if you can restore some ecological values, you should do that. And we'd need some parameters on that, obviously. But it seems to me that if you get, you know, a couple of dug firs in the remaining 20 feet on a 300-foot buffer, most of which is separated, we've still restored some value. And then we ought to restore the value if we could. And then my other question has nothing to do with this. So no. Are we, do you want me just to go on to my other unrelated question, Mr. Mayor, or you want to wait?
I'm fine. I'm looking to staff to see if there's.
Yeah, I think if the proposal is to, you've identified areas that have been degraded, let's say a parking lot.
Yeah.
But some portion further afield, perhaps you could do some restorative plantings, that the expectation would be to require that.
I think it's really two things. One, the question is, we have to say what happens once you identify this. It either has to flat out say it's outside of the CARA, or it has to say it's still in the CARA, but different rules apply, and here are the different rules. And what I would ideally like is different rules that maximize the ecological benefit while recognizing that we're never going to get to the point of full function, given that parts of it are physically separated.
Okay.
Right, and then my other question has to do with the public comment on the CARA. There's a map in there as one of the attachments. You can pull it up if you want, but it's the supplemental Edmonds CARA map. Mm-hmm. And it looks to me like we've got just a little dip of that sort of the outside edge of the Deer Creek CARA that comes into shoreline. And so my question is, one, I'd love a response to the comments that were made tonight as to whether we have to designate that. And two, assuming we did designate that as part of a CARA, how would that change our code? And that may be something you have to get back to us on, and that's fine.
We've been in discussions with Olympic View for a while now about the status of their wellhead protection area. And we actually were able to have a meeting with Department of Ecology, Department of Health, Olympic View, and City of Shoreline staff to try to understand each other's different perspectives and different roles here so that we could figure out if this is something that is required. Ultimately, what we came away with is that a wellhead protection area can be a CARA, but it isn't necessarily a mapped one-to-one. If you have a wellhead protection, it automatically is, so there's not that specific requirement. We also understand that the area that comes into shoreline is a buffer from the wellhead protection area, not the wellhead protection area itself. and Olympic View shared their reasoning for having a buffer. But ultimately, through our correspondence and review of code requirements and meeting with these agencies, the staff's recommendation hasn't changed. We do not believe that a CARA is a requirement here.
And looking at the map, that reflects that. And so my follow-on question is, it's not a lot of dirt in shoreline, so what's the harm to designating it as they've requested?
Sure. Designating something as a critical area when it doesn't meet that requirement can prove challenging to property owners who maybe are looking to develop or do something and then understand that there's potentially additional reporting requirements that are necessary or limitations on uses, those types of things. It's also the code update has really been focused on simplifying and clarifying processes, being really clear about what's required and what's not, and to add something that we do not believe is a critical area, saying that it is seems to muddle that approach.
I appreciate all of that. I also know that area there, and it's a gas station. It's a big parking lot for the whole Costco complex, and then there's a little bit of residential, but it seems to me that these are potentially businesses that might have a huge impact, even in a buffer area. So I don't have the technical knowledge to argue with that response, and so I'm not inclined to shoot from the hip, but I would encourage us to take a close look at whether there's something we can do, because Olympic View has been telling us about this for years and years, and I get that we disagree on the legal definitions, but I think we're all on the same page with maximizing environmental protection, particularly when you've got an aquifer and a gas station on top of it.
Thank you. Councilmember Adamasu.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for your building map examples. Mm-hmm. I found that very helpful when we can see an example. So I have kind of three areas I want to talk about and ask questions. I did speak with some staff and Olympic View. So I'm in favor of protecting water quality and quantity in the buffer zone. It is part of the critical aquifer recharge area because the assessment that was done included both the wellhead protection area and the buffer zone. And when the Department of Health approved it, it was all combined as one piece, not separate. So I want to look at what are ways to protect this drinking water aquifer. Is it by adding the sentence that Olympic View has asked us to add this one sentence, or are there other ways? And I don't know the answer to this, so I'll talk about some other ways. It could be this one sentence, or could the city have an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, with the Water District? So it could outline, you know, if more building was done, different uses, how can this buffer zone be protected? And in our permitting department, whenever I understand there's comments on each parcel, so how do we know that that's going to continue on into the future? Like, people come and go, like, is this permanently on each property, a comment about protection of the buffer zone underneath whatever could be built in the future. And I am concerned also with, we've got two gas stations in the area too, with Costco and the other one on the corner. So there have been PFAS detected in the Edmonds area where they have underground injection wells. So let's say the gas station potentially left and they built a 6-floor apartment building on it. And they decided to put an underground injection well for stormwater control. That could affect the buffer zone of this aquifer. So I just want to be sure any future decisions on changes in property will protect this buffer area for wellhead protection. So what does staff think about ways to protect it? Why wouldn't this one sentence be enough to protect it? Or do you think an MOU would be a better way and explain?
Well, our I think some of the language that we've seen from Olympic View around making sure that we have appropriate uses is already handled by our zoning code. We're not going to have a landfill or allow septic here. Like, it's handled by other development regulations. Concepts around underground injection wells, that's handled in our stormwater code. So the planning staff who would administer this critical areas code aren't, they are not stormwater planners. So we would really be looking to our partners in Public Works to say what is appropriate in terms of infiltration and treatment for stormwater. And so why that ends up in the critical areas code is not clear, like what the deficit is. If the concern is around stormwater, is that the more appropriate place?
Because that's citywide, and you may allow it in one area that's not in a recharge area, but maybe you'd look at an underground injection well, like maybe it's not a good idea in this area.
And so the staff who review the critical areas code are not the same as who review stormwater and vice versa. So the folks looking at stormwater and is an underground injection well appropriate are not looking at the critical areas code. So I still think we're seeing a gap there and would imagine handling stormwater concerns, even if they are site specific, handling it in one place, the stormwater code, at least that's one place where folks are going to get guidance on what type of design, treatment, infiltration is appropriate.
So then you're saying the stormwater code already has it in there, that if you're in a buffer zone for a wellhead protection area, that you would look at, is underground injection appropriate in this area? Is that in the stormwater manual?
Not administering the stormwater code, I can't speak to it.
So I just want to be assured that this critical drinking water area is protected. So then the other two minor things, short things, what Thornton Creek Alliance has asked, you mentioned how it's not very common for your critical areas reasonable use permits being issued, like that's a rarer thing. And they've asked that when it is required, what would asking for a variance application in addition, what does that entail?
I think they're sort of two different terms meeting the same thing. A variance is a modification to the land use code for things that aren't outright allowed. In like terms of development standards, height, what have you. The critical areas code sort of does that in its own way in a reasonable use permit. And it requires very specific criteria that include adequate mitigation and no net loss of ecological function that like the land use code doesn't really contemplate. So it sort of is a variance by another term.
Okay. All right, thank you. And then lastly, the second item asked for by Thornton Creek Alliance, it seemed like your maps where you gave examples of if you are going to extend and you're within the certain number of feet, that more plantings are required, correct? So trees, you know, native plantings, your maps made it look like that's already a requirement, correct? If you're...
Correct. Yes. So the concepts that we have around the riparian management zone are, I think this is the one that you were referring
to. Yes, correct.
Yes, is that you don't just get to expand.
Yes.
Just because.
Okay.
There
All
needs
right.
to be mitigation.
Okay, thank yeah. you. All right.
Deputy Mayor Marcus. Sorry.
My colleagues and I are all thinking along the same kind of lines. Getting back to the Thornton Creek Alliance, just to start off, I think the request was to have some kind of idea on how many times we are saying that the one-time expansion that you showed with the 500 feet is being allowed. I don't know what the right word for asking to have the ability to count those, but I think that's really what they're asking is it's fine to do this, but we should have some kind of understanding. Is there a way to do that then?
Yes. So presently it's not allowed. So this would be a mm-hmm. new thing that we're mm-hmm. proposing. Included in this requirement is a notice on title that someone has essentially used up their uh-huh. One-time expansion, and then we can incorporate that into our city mapping software so that we understand for future permitting activity that this has actually already happened and someone can't, you know, a few years later be like, oh, can I please yeah. have it again? We would monitor that.
So I think that's important, and I would like to make sure that happens. The second thing that Councilmember Adamasu was taking you to and what we heard comments on is the request on the map that you have there on the screen that the plants be required to be native. Is it required to be native in any place, or is it just say put plants?
They need to be native, site appropriate, and at natural okay. densities.
So it's already in there?
Correct.
Okay, that's that one. I really liked Councilmember Scully's what's the harm mm-hmm. when we talk about the aquifer. That clearly there is, Olympic View has spent time and effort identifying that the area that is in the recharge zone. And from their perspective, the buffer area is the same as the basic area for the reason that of the overlaying soils and you know the conditions there, so that they clearly feel very strongly that this falls into this. They also clearly feel very strongly that they'd like to have some kind of way that this is known as we move forward, so that it's not something that gets lost in the shades of time. And I can appreciate that staff has views on this, but it concerns me when we have a basic disagreement on yes or no, is this an aquifer recharge zone? And my hope is that we can come to some kind of terms that is acceptable to both parties. You know, my colleagues have expounded on very eloquently the concern on drinking water, and you know, I don't want to, for the purpose of simplifying code, get that lost. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to sort of return to this question about native plantings and riparian zones. I'm not seeing where that is required, and if staff could get back to me exactly, because what I read in 2080-320E, which is page 8A108 for those following along, it just says that enhancements, talking about enhancements, they have to, it just says a planting plan is required. So, I mean, I could be missing it, and there could be, I mean, there's lots of things happening, as Councilmember Scully alluded to earlier, but it does not, it almost doesn't look like there's requirements for plants to be, anything to be done other than a planting, a report and a plan to plant more things. So that's sort of one question I'd like an answer to. Again, if you don't have it now, that's fine. The second question is sort of thinking about sort of buffers and where, how you sort of figure out how, when a site is being is already impacted. So many, in fact, most of the properties in Shoreline have buffers on each side of the house, generally, but structure. How do we, and then there's a sort of non-permanent structures out there, so the sheds and things like that. How do you determine, are you, when someone looks at the sort of where something is impacted, do you look at sort of every sort of aspect of the property? So in where four is, I mean, there's buffers. How would you sort of try to figure out, I mean, does the buffer extend all the way sort of just on a straight line from the stream to the 200 foot or until there's another obstruction?
So the...
So if you look at number three, I mean, you have that sort of modified riparian management zone, which goes to the street, but you have the buffer on property three that sort of, there's nothing in between. Would that be considered part of the buffer?
So what three is showing is a addition.
Right. I'm not looking at the addition. Okay. I'm looking at sort of on the sides, sort of the side, the building to the property line.
Okay.
Would that be part of that in theoretically? So if I look to the left or to the right of the building, this mark
sure,
three.
The side setback.
The sides,
sure.
Yeah. Should those be?
I think that it will depend. It'll depend on the condition, what is occurring there. Ultimately, the baseline is to have a professional assessment by a qualified professional. If it's something that's very clearly does not have a relationship, that could be potentially waived. So, yes, this is a simple illustrative.
I understand. Yeah. I'm just trying to understand that. I mean, it could be that buffer, the sort of buffers from the property line to the, could be or may not. Yeah, okay.
Correct.
And when we're thinking about what's happening in the buffers, a fence, a sort of a fence would not necessarily be an impediment because it's removable, but impervious structure such as concrete, something like that, would or could be a barrier.
Potentially, yes, because it's about those critical ecosystem functions that a riparian management zone is performing. So those are things like pollutant removal, shade from large trees, detrital nutrients. So there's a bunch of these, and if they're not doing any of those things, then it's not a riparian management zone.
But so if someone's asking for a reduction, could removal of some, if there was a structure that was identified, could removal of a structure be something that could be part of a plan to reduce the buffer? So if there
was... Potentially.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, like you have a shed or something back there, and if I remove that and I put some nice plantings there and, yeah, make it better, yes, that could be part of the enhancement sort of package.
Okay. And so what we're saying sort of broadly is within 100 feet from a stream, unless there's some impediment, no new or the 500 foot... Or
not,
really not even within the
500 foot.
Not even the 500 foot.
Yeah.
So if there's a property within 100 feet, you're not going to see any expansion of that existing structure. You're not going to see new structures within 100 feet. But within between 100 feet and 200 feet or 300 feet, depending on the thing, you're not going to see, you may see new development or new things happen in that 100 to 200 or 100 to 300 foot buffer, depending on what is already there.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It depends, because that's only if something is already there. So if you have a pristine, untouched riparian management zone, that's not that doesn't get a one-time expansion. But yeah, the concept is that you cannot get closer to the stream. There may be potential if you're just trying to do a small porch addition on one side of your property. That might be totally appropriate because the stream's behind you. So there are, I think, some edge cases. Potentially you could go up rather than going out. So there are ways that development or alteration can still occur.
So what would happen, just for illustrative purposes, what would happen if someone wanted to tear down the entire structure? Mm-hmm. What happens then?
Demolition is allowed. And if it is within the existing footprint of that demolished structure, you could potentially rebuild. So you can't get, larger than what was there already.
In terms of its footprint.
Exactly, in terms of its footprint, but maybe it goes higher potentially.
What about, thinking of those lines, what about driveways and sort of other is that still the footprint of the?
Right, essentially it's sort of a concept of you get what you've got, you can maintain what you've got. If let's say you need to replace your driveway, it's cracked or something like that, you could take it out and then repave in that exact same area. But the concept is you don't get larger, you don't get additional impacts.
Okay. Councilor Scully.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on some of the comments that were made on the wellhead protection area. So I challenge the assertion that sort of stormwater and zoning get us there. Like if you have an acre parcel and you've got zoned MB, you can have lot line to lot line impervious surface. But if there's a stream running through it, you can't do that. And that has nothing to do with the zoning, and that has nothing to do with the stormwater. That's what the critical areas ordinance does. However, my question of what's the harm is stupid, because the harm of saying something that doesn't meet our legal interpretation is that thing is a problem. I mean, we need to apply our code consistently when we get there. But given the depth with which Olympic View has pursued this over the years, I think we're all on the same page, and I'm hoping there's a way we can work it out, given how small a slice of shoreline is with the intensive businesses that are there now that are going to be grandfathered in no matter what anybody says, to sort of get on the same page with them. When you've got resolutions flying back and forth, the last thing I want is a lawsuit with one agency suing the other, given that we all want to protect the critical area and it's not much of shoreline's landmass we're talking about. So I'm hoping we can continue negotiations with those folks and see if we can't work out a compromise.
We are in conversations. In fact, we met with their attorney today, and we're coming up with, I think that what we would like, staff would like to make sure that what we come up with actually addresses the concerns and the issues, and it might not be through the critical areas ordinance, and so that's what we're trying to work through.
No, and I think that's right. And if it doesn't meet our definition, then we should,
correct.
We either need to revise the definition or we need to find a workaround. But
right.
I think we're on exactly the same page.
Exactly.
There's got to be a way where we can meet the policy goals here.
Yeah, and
without
that's our
bending
intent.
The,
our intent is to make sure that the actual concerns get addressed, and there could be many different ways to do that. So that's what we're working
on. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? When is this expected to come back?
The 15th.
And I think there was some questions out there with some potential amendments about, depending on the answers, around native plantings and depending on where the staff is on the wellhead issue. Is that still sufficient time to get answers and then prepare amendments, or how are we feeling about the timeline? I know it's rushed, it may be rushed.
I would say for the making sure native plantings language is in there and taking a closer look at that physically separated, functionally isolated language, that is not a problem. The wellhead protection area, I would need to get back to you.
Okay. And if we don't have resolution on that issue before we need to come back to this council this year, even though this is required to be done every 10 years or following the our comprehensive plan, can we still amend it in the future, or is this our one time of doing these amendments?
We can still amend it in the future, and I'd probably speak with the city's attorney's office about the best approach, if it needs a longer timeline, if there's, you know, how much risk if it gets resolved in January, right, versus doing a whole other, go back through Planning Commission, go back to City Council.
I think we'd probably have, if it's separate, it'd probably have to go through Planning Commission anyway.
Exactly.
But we, if we can't resolve, if there's no resolution on the wellhead issue, it can come back in 2026, and that would, and that would be fine. It just wouldn't be in what we adopt on the 15th.
We'll address that. We can provide some responses to some alternatives of ways forward with respect to whether it's addressing it in an amendment or some other ways. And I will go ahead and talk about all of that, staff will, when I respond to the council's concerns.
Okay. Deputy Mayor Moore.
I just wanted to make sure that the whole concept of the notion of counting how many exceptions, that we also have that thought through.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we'll see this back on the 15th of December. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is a discussion of ordinance number 1049, amending Shoreline Municipal Code Chapter 3.22, Business and Occupation Tax regarding tax classification updates. And there is a staff report. If we go 30 minutes, as this is, as our agenda suggests, I will be surprised.
No, it will not be that long. 10 minutes.
Unless you want us to ask all the detailed probing questions.
This will be short and sweet.
Welcome.
All right, good evening, Mayor, Deputy Mayor, Council Members. Tonight, we're here to discuss Ordinance 1049, amending the Shoreline Municipal Code 3.22 regarding tax classifications. Now I'll pass it off to Johanna Miller, our B&O tax analyst, to give you more details.
Good evening. As of October, our Senate passed Bill 58.
Can you speak a little bit closer to the microphone?
As of October, our Senate passed Bill 5814 to change the state's definition of retail sales to include additional services that you see on the screen. The Association of Washington Cities has updated their business and occupation tax model ordinance to reflect changes from Senate Bill 5814, including moving selected services to the retail sales tax classification, adding language to the definition of sale at retail and sale at wholesale to parallel the Senate bill, and correcting a typo regarding extended warranties. Proposed ordinance number 1049 changes the code to move selected services to the retail tax classification. It also adds language to the definition of sale at retail and sale at wholesale to parallel the Senate bill, and it corrects the typo regarding extended warranties. There is no action required at this time. Ordinance number 1049 is proposed for adoption at the December 8th meeting.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Councilman Otto wants to.
Thank you. Can you remind me, what's the annual, is it $500,000 where the B&O tax starts?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm just wondering, small businesses have a hard time starting out. Is there any way we could phase in a B&O tax for a small business starting out, trying to start out here in Shoreline, phase in a B&O tax over 5 years, like 10% the first year, 20% the second, 40, 60, 80, give some kind of relief for a small business to start here in Shoreline? I know our adjacent city, South Seattle, has gotten rid of the B&O tax for, I don't know what their numbers are, but, you know, maybe something small business between $500,000 and $1 million, like that lower income level. Is it too late to look at something like this? Maybe, if not this year, next year?
I think we can certainly look into that.
Yeah.
Okay. Get back to you.
Okay, but is it too late for this year?
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So next year, but yeah, I'd love to see it next year.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Scully.
Two things. That kind of a wholesale relook, I think we should consider, but that's the kind of thing that we need to go either through the mayor or the city manager or get two council members kind of thing and tee it up and look at it that way. And then my only question is, what's the typo? I can't find it. It's just bugging me.
Yeah, so I believe it just references the wrong section.
Section,
so
okay, gotcha.
So it references section 7 instead of section 8.
Gotcha.
Okay. I can get you the page number.
No, that's okay. I was hoping it was something funny, but.
It's very minimal, yeah.
Any further comments? Okay, not 30 minutes.
Nope.
Nope.
Okay, with that, this meeting is adjourned.